One of the givens of the annual New Zealand International Film Festival is a strong music section, and this year is no different. The highlight is a documentary about 70s legends The Band, called Once Were Brothers. Simon Morris with the story.
The story of The Band was a beautiful thing. It was so beautiful it went up in flames.
There is no band that emphasizes becoming greater than the sum of their parts than the band. Simply their name, The Band.
The effect of The Band's first two albums on the Woodstock generation was momentous. At a time when everyone was turning up the volume and heading into the psychedelic future, these four Canadians and an Arkansas drummer did the opposite. They turned right down and looked back into America's past. At times they seem more at home in the 1870s than the 1970s. Well, I'm joined by the director of Once Were Brothers, Daniel Rohr. Hi, Daniel. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
It is such a great story, but surely it's been told before. I mean, notably in Martin Scorsese's The Last Waltz. So what's different about this version?
Well, this is a totally different story. The band story was sort of told in The Last Waltz. I would say that The Last Waltz is more of a concert film, a celebration of their career. But in my movie, I really delve into their history, the foundational elements of the group. And my film is specifically through the lens and point of view of their guitar player and principal songwriter, Robbie Robertson. So the film tells the story of this young man growing up in Toronto who dreamed of having this big life and finding a stage for himself and playing his music all over the world. And it's the tale of how he hooked up with these four random musicians and went on the ride of a lifetime, backing up some of the most incredible musicians in history and making their own musical mark that will live on forever.
The title of the film, Once Were Brothers, seems to sum up that it's about relationships, and it's specifically about one relationship, really, isn't it?
That's an interesting point of view, but my perspective and what I always thought about is that this film is a love story. It's about these five young men who forged a loving friendship bond and the music that they made together as a result of it. But like any good love story, I guess, this one is a tragedy insofar as that their creative collaboration ultimately was impossible. And I think what the title speaks to is just this idea that when you're 17 years old, you're not thinking about the rest of your life. You're only thinking about tomorrow. You have your four or five best friends by your side. You're making music. You're traveling from city to city. You're slumming it. You're the king of the world. But then you get successful. And someone gives you $1 million and you have wives and children and people change and it's unsustainable. So what I think of with this film is how it's really about the impossibility of creative collaboration. In particular, I think the film is really about Robbie's relationship with his best friend, Levon Helm, who really, in my mind, is the soul of the band.
It's interesting that somebody referred to the band as America's Beatles. I mean, what do you think about that description?
I think that is, you know, a really incredible thing to say. I'm obviously partial, but I'd take the band over the Beatles any day. That might not be a popular opinion, but it was the great blues man Taj Mahal who said that. And I think what he was speaking to is just this originality, this sound that seemed to come out of nowhere, this unique approach to music as the world was embracing psychedelic sounds and guitar solos that went off into space, the band was doing something that was a little bit more homespun, that maybe would make you want to step off onto the front porch and start whittling a piece of wood or learn how to play the fiddle. That was the band sound, and I think that's why it captivated so many people. It was new and fresh, but it sounded like it had always been there, and it had this really antiquated, beautiful quality.
There are a number of similarities to the Beatles, aside from the fact that they changed everything, but it was also a unique musical blend, and it needed all five to make it work.
And that's really the magic and beauty of this band. And one of the pieces of criticism that I have received from the film is its title, Robbie Robertson and the Band. With the obvious note being, this isn't Robbie's band, it's the band. And that's totally true. I think the name of the film reflects more having to do with marketing it and getting people to watch it. But the reality was, here was a group that was greater than the sum of its parts. If you take one guy out of this group, you don't have the group anymore. And these were guys who grew up together. They've cut their musical teeth together. And you're absolutely right. You take one guy out of the equation and you don't have the whole thing. But what I would question and what I would encourage your viewers who are band fans, who are familiar with this historic perceived conflict between Robbie and Levon, to consider that although the group is greater than the sum of its parts, I don't think all the parts are equal in what they bring to the table. And that's obviously a controversial opinion, but one that I think is illustrated in the movie.
I think one point also that was raised in the movie is the fact that most bands, the focus is on the singer. And that's not the case in this group. The focus of a lot of the accounts of this band were on the songwriter. Three guys were the lead singers, none of whom were Robbie. And there was Garth Hudson in the back. An extraordinary combination, isn't it?
It really is. And you know, that speaks to the, how unique these guys were. They weren't really rock stars. They didn't aspire to be rock stars. They were musicians, the noblest of professions. You couldn't put a guy like Richard Manuel next to Mick Jagger or someone like one of these legendary big personalities of the 20th century. They were small town Canadian kids who found themselves in extraordinary circumstances. You know, that's an amazing, wonderful thing, but I don't think those guys were quite comfortable being the face of the group. I don't think they cared for that extra celebrity and attention. I don't think they enjoyed doing interviews. And I think that's why it was up to Robbie to really take the lead. And at the end of the day, I don't think Robbie minded being the face of the group. I think he enjoyed the extra attention. And I think he really liked the idea of being the songwriting genius and the genius guitarist that he was framed in magazines and things like this.
I noted that they were famous for playing with Bob Dylan, but Bob Dylan wasn't the guy who put them together. That was another guy, Ronnie Hawkins.
Ronnie Hawkins is this legendary rockabilly singer who essentially moved up to Canada in the mid-50s because he could bring his band from the South and get tons of work playing in Toronto. It's quite an amazing story. So these guys would come up to Canada, which to them was like the promised land. So foreign. The first time Levon Helm ever went up to Toronto, he didn't even know if they would speak English. He wasn't sure what language they would speak up there. And Ronnie became a Canadian legend. He played on Yonge Street in Toronto, was a fixture of the rock scene in Toronto for many, many years. He still lives up a bit north of Toronto in a beautiful town called Peterborough, and he's just such a character. But when those guys were 15, 16, 17 years old, they all came together and started playing with Ronnie. And Robbie was one of the first kids who weaseled his way into this Southern rockabilly band. And the only way he was able to do it is by working twice as hard and really just trying to fake it until he made it.
The scene in Toronto sounds extraordinary. I've seen interviews with Levon Helm in particular where he's talking about the range of music, top music stars who would be playing in Toronto. It sounded like a sort of northern New Orleans or something. I mean, what was the scene like in Toronto at that stage?
Well, it's quite interesting because I grew up in this town. This is my hometown. I still live in Toronto. And I never really knew about Toronto's musical history until I made this film. And I'm talking to you from my house in downtown. If I walk down the street, there's a historic plaque outside of our famous music store in Toronto, Long & McQuaid, that sells musical instruments. And it says that this was the home of the Le Coq d'Or, which was one of the great rock and roll clubs in Toronto. And these clubs, there were many of them, would book big American acts that were coming through, rock and roll acts, rockabilly acts. And on Saturday nights in Toronto, these places would be absolutely lit. And you could hear Cannonball Adderley or Bo Diddley or Chuck Berry or Ronnie Hawkins. And this Canadian city, which was always known as Toronto the Good, the Queen City, had this sort of like dark rock and roll gritty underbelly. And Robbie was this young street urchin who grew up amongst the gangsters and sex workers and really nefarious characters that occupied these clubs and rock and roll joints. And I think he loved it.
How did they meet Bob Dylan? Because I know at the time Bob Dylan was planning to go electric, as they said, it seemed an odd choice to pick this Canadian band.
You're absolutely right. It's so funny because if you asked Robbie Robertson in 1963 who Bob Dylan was, he probably wouldn't know. Those guys were not interested in folk music. Rich college kids listen to folk music in their tweed jackets. These guys were playing clubs along the Chitlin' circuit. They were playing rough and tumble joints, playing rough, gritty rock and roll. So they had no association or awareness of Bob Dylan. But they were introduced to this guy in New York, and I think it was in 65, Robbie was introduced to this guy, actually at a recording studio. Robbie's friend invited him to this recording session that the songwriter was having. And lo and behold, it's the recording session at Columbia Studios for Like a Rolling Stone. Robbie meets this guy, this flash of energy. And Robbie Robertson, I'm sure, is used to being the coolest guy in every room he's ever in. And I think that when he's in a room with a 22-year-old Bob Dylan, he gets a run for his money. And the two strike up a friendship based around music. And Dylan wants to change his musical style. He's tired of the tried and true. And he wants to get a little grittier and a little bit more electric, add some power to his sound. And he finds this R&B band from Canada to be the perfect people to come along on the journey.
When they went on the road, I mean, playing in places like Britain and being booed at around the world, basically, who was teaching who?
Well, that's a great question. I'm sure Bob Dylan learned a lot about being in a band, about playing with other musicians from these guys. But at the end of the day, it's absolutely clear that Robbie Robertson's genius is that he was able to absorb a little bit of that Bob Dylan magic, whereas the other guys would go and party and go sightseeing. You know, there's lovely Super 8 footage of Garth Hudson going sightseeing. Robbie was next to Dylan, watching Dylan write songs. He was paying attention to how Dylan thinks and facilitates himself. And I think that some of that genius rubbed off on him a little bit. I don't know if Robbie becomes the songwriter he did without Dylan's influence. But they developed a really close relationship. They were very close friends. I think they really did influence one another.
What happened at the end of the tour was that they all retired to Woodstock. They all sort of ended up in this sort of small town in the back blocks of New York State. And they started making up this completely new music.
It's quite an amazing story, and I really think this speaks to the power and significance of physical place. These guys just came off of a whirlwind world tour. They were planning another one. And then, of course, Dylan has his motorcycle accident. He fractures his neck. He's bedridden. And the other guys eventually move from the big city, New York, where they couldn't find a studio space or rehearsal space. There's tons of room up in Woodstock, and they want to be around Bob. And so they go up there. They rent this ugly pink house, and every afternoon for 3 or 4 hours, Bob comes over, and they're just jamming and playing and making music without a care in the world. The guys in the band were on a stipend. They got a little bit of money from Bob Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, enough to live off of, and they were just playing music as if no one was listening. What's genius about the Basement Tapes is that they were composed in a setting and place where it was the expectation that no one would ever hear these songs. And it was only later that they became this epic, magical, incredible thing. But of course, the songs that came out of that time and place are absolutely legendary. And then eventually Bob Dylan goes off to do Nashville Skyline. Robbie starts writing his own songs. And the band, out of nowhere, comes out with this incredible Music from Big Pink album.
You'd think that a band that had been on the road around the South playing rockabilly and juke joints and things like that would be just playing old-fashioned rock and roll. But there's such a mix. There's jazz, there's blues, there's Tin Pan Alley, there's bits of Stephen Foster, there's bits of so much stuff. It was an extraordinary mix, wasn't it?
Absolutely, and that speaks to the musical education of each one of the guys. Robbie Robertson grew up playing country songs on his mom's indigenous reserve, the Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve outside of Toronto, because, of course, Robbie's mother was Mohawk First Nations. And so he would go to the reserve and play country songs. Garth Hudson grew up as a choir boy singing gospel. And then he got into jazz and was into Middle Eastern music, all sorts of interesting things. Richard Manuel's idol was Ray Charles. So they would bring those type of sounds to the arena. And then, of course, Lee Vaughn was from the heart of it all, from the Mississippi Delta in Arkansas. And he grew up going to these minstrel shows and listening to Sonny Boy Williams on the radio in Helena, Arkansas. And all of these interests and tastes come together and mix into this pot of gumbo that is like nothing anyone has ever heard before. And at a time when the psychedelic music was really taking over, I think this homespun, home-cooked music really resonated.
I think if I have a regret about the film, which has got all this wonderful footage and interesting interviews, is that the relationship between Robbie and Levon seems to overshadow the others in the film. I mean, it's over an hour before you get a good Rick Danko vocal. I mean, was that something that concerned you, the fact that the other three tended to fade a little in the background?
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up, and it absolutely is a challenge when you're making a film and trying to capture 38 years of musical history. It's very difficult to have everything you want in the movie. If only you were in the edit room with us as we were cutting songs and I was crying on the floor to keep one track in or one scene in that we just didn't have time for.
Yeah.
It's a very valid comment, and it's something that I'm sorry about, that we don't get to know those guys as well as we should. It's just challenging, given the constraints of time and all that we have to work in, I think, to faithfully represent every guy. We tried really hard to give everyone a moment, everyone a solo, at least try and show and illustrate the genius of each member. But just given the medium and given the time constraints, it is obviously difficult, and it's a very fair and appreciated note. But when it comes to Garth specifically, we actually did shoot an interview with Garth Hudson. I went up to Woodstock and had the most bizarre and weirdest experience going to meet Garth. I had to meet him at the Kingston Diner in Woodstock at 12:30 at night. He didn't show up till 2 in the morning after a 10-hour drive from Toronto to New York. And it was just a bizarre weekend. But anyone who knows Garth and is a fan will tell you that he's a very unique, idiosyncratic guy. And I don't think Garth is as articulate as someone like Robbie. And his interview really didn't give us anything that would add to the film. So we decided to have Garth's voice be in the movie through archival material, which was helpful. Even though it was a regret that he's not in it in the contemporary sense, it was a great honor. And I'll never forget going down there to shoot that interview.
I did an interview myself with Garth Hudson about 3 years ago, and I'm so grateful I did it on radio because I could actually chop out all the ears and ums and stuff like that. He was, as you say, a unique individual, but such a brilliant musician. I know that the point of the movie in some respects was the bad feeling that came out after The Last Waltz, when Levon in particular thought that Robbie was taking credit for everything that the band had done and got very angry about that, didn't he?
I obviously never met Levon. I never discussed this with him, but I've read his book, and it's very clear. Anyone who reads his book can tell that there was a lot of bitterness there, which is a very sad thing. And this is often characterized as a conflict or a fight. And it's, I think, a mischaracterization, because the truth of the matter is, and I can attest this, I grilled Robbie on these questions for, 2 years, and Robbie only ever had love and respect for Levon. And I think Robbie understood where some of Levon's frustration and anger came from. And Robbie's mind, that was just Levon being Levon. And, the same grudges that Levon used to hold towards promoters and other musicians in the early 60s is the same energy that Robbie picked up on later in life. And I think Robbie always felt that was very, very sad. And I know Robbie. I've spent a lot of time with Robbie. Robbie doesn't do anything he doesn't want to do. He doesn't put himself in situations, I think, that are outside of his comfort zone. He has a very specific caliber of people that he likes to hang out with. He's very hooked up in LA and in Hollywood. But when Levon was passing away, he made the trip to go see Levon. And to me, that was a very profound gesture that really speaks to the love and devotion he had towards Lee, and really paid respect to the beautiful music they made together.
Simon Morris talking with Daniel Rohr, whose documentary Once Were Brothers, Robbie Robertson and the Band, is playing as part of the New Zealand International Film Festival.